Welcome to UDEM Research Active Recovery Series.
This is The Deep Dive.
And today, we are tackling a challenge that, well, it hits every single dedicated athlete, usually somewhere around their 40th birthday.
Right.
You suddenly realize recovery isn't just about how hard you train anymore, it's about how smart you recover.
Your entire physiological capacity,
yeah,
it just changes. It forces a complete strategic overhaul of everything you thought you knew.
Absolutely. And the central challenge we've distilled from all the sources, from all the material, is what we're calling the recovery paradox.
The interventions that cost the most, the ones that look the most high-tech and impressive on social media.
The cryo chambers, the fancy boots.
Exactly. They very often yield the absolute lowest return on investment, or ROI.
And look, when you're 40, you're trying to balance a career, family, and you're still training hard. Every hour, every dollar, it has to count.
For sure. So our mission for this deep dive is pretty straightforward.
Great.
We want to give you a personalized, evidence-based recovery stack.
We've synthesized market analysis, practitioner guidance, and some landmark meta-analyses.
And some of those findings, especially on cold water aversion, are genuinely surprising. We're here to help you prioritize the quickest, most effective wins.
The things that have the lowest friction.
Right. And show you how to strategically time every single intervention so it actually supports your training and doesn't derail your long-term adaptation goals.
We have hard numbers on what matters most. We're going to detail the exact protein dose you need now, why your sleep environment is completely non-negotiable, and how to use your wearable to track trends that are actually meaningful and filter out all that daily noise.
Okay, let's get into it.
Let's unpack this and start with the reality of, well, the aging muscle.
Part one.
So we have to start with this physiological reality check. Why does it feel like soreness lingers for 2 days instead of one? It can honestly feel like your body's entire operating system has been updated, and not necessarily for the better.
It can.
What are the core physiological shifts that make a recovery plan so critical after 40?
Well, that feeling you're describing, it's completely real. It's backed by objective data. The foundational change is something we call delayed functional recovery.
Okay, break that down for us.
So, while the initial amount of muscle damage from a really hard session might be comparable to what a younger athlete gets.
Right.
The restoration process, so getting that muscle back to full strength, full mobility, that process is significantly delayed.
How delayed are we talking?
Considerably longer.
Mm.
The research consistently shows it takes 48 hours or even more in middle-aged groups. This is the biological reason you feel like you need more time between your hard sessions.
And if you don't take that time...
If you try to maintain the same training density you had in your 20s,
yeah,
you are almost certainly just stacking unrecovered fatigue on top of existing damage. You have to respect that biological reality.
That delay is the critical difference. And I understand it's compounded by another concept that completely changes how we should eat. It's called anabolic resistance of aging.
It is. Anabolic resistance is, simply put, the reduced sensitivity of your muscle tissue to standard anabolic stimuli.
And the main stimulus being protein.
Exactly. Protein paired with resistance training. Think of your muscle cells like a locked door, and the protein you eat is the key.
Okay.
As you age, that lock gets a little bit stickier. The key doesn't turn as easily. Your muscles just require a higher dose of protein to get the same effect to maximize what we call muscle protein synthesis, or MPS.
And we have hard numbers on how much higher that requirement is, don't we?
We do, and it's dramatic. Studies show that older, untrained adults need about 0.4 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, just at rest, to maximize that MPS.
And compared to a younger person?
It's about 65% greater.
65%? That's a colossal difference.
It's huge. It's not a small margin. And it tells you immediately that any generic protein recommendation you've been following is probably obsolete if you're over 40.
So it's not just about the post-workout shake anymore. It's about being vigilant about protein all day long.
All day. And the challenge continues, even for masters athletes who train consistently.
Mm.
Some studies found that even when eating identical high-protein diets, the actual muscle-building process, that myofibrillar protein synthesis, was still about 16% lower in older athletes during recovery.
So it's manageable, but you have to be deliberate.
You have to use a consistently higher dose approach to nutrition, which we'll detail a little later on.
Okay, so beyond muscle sensitivity, there's our internal chemical environment, our hormones. What's happening there after 40 that directly impacts repair?
We really have to look at two critical systems. First is growth hormone, and second is the testosterone to cortisol balance.
Right.
So growth hormone, or GH, is absolutely essential for cellular repair, but it declines significantly. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 15 to 20% per decade, after you turn 30.
Wow.
Think of GH as the body's night shift repair crew. As you age, the boss just calls them in less often, so repairs stall.
So if that repair crew is already shrinking, what's the most important lever we have left to control its release?
Sleep quality. It's that simple and that critical. The research is clear that GH release is intrinsically coupled with deep sleep, specifically what we call slow wave sleep, or SWS.
And that's a type of sleep that often declines with age.
It does. So if your sleep architecture is compromised, your GH release is blunted, and that directly hurts your ability to repair tissue.
Mm.
This is why sleep optimization is absolutely non-negotiable. It directly controls a recovery hormone that's already taking a hit from age.
And then you mentioned the stress hormones.
Right. This is where it gets compounded. Testosterone, which helps maintain muscle, declines about 1% annually after 30.
Okay.
At the same time, cortisol, the body's main stress hormone, tends to increase. This shift creates these extended catabolic states post-exercise.
Meaning your body stays in a muscle breakdown mode for longer.
Exactly. It impairs repair because you can't shift back into that anabolic or building state as quickly as a younger athlete can.
We hear the term inflammaging a lot in the sources. It sounds pretty dramatic. Can you define that for us and explain why this matters for a recovery strategy?
Inflammaging is just a term to define the state of low-grade, chronic, elevated baseline levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines, things like interleukin-6 or IL-6 that older adults often maintain.
So it's like the body's alarm system is just always on at a low hum.
That's a great way to put it. It's always at a level 3 out of 10. Then you stack the acute inflammation from a hard workout on top of that elevated baseline, and you create an environment that really impairs overall recovery.
That sounds pretty grim, but here's where the data offers a really powerful counterpoint, a great reason to stay consistent.
Absolutely. This is the positive nuance. The research is unequivocal. Consistent, lifelong exercise substantially attenuates or lessens this age-related inflammation.
So our training is actually protecting us.
Massively. Masters athletes show significantly lower C-reactive protein, which is a key inflammatory marker. The standardized mean difference, or SMD, is negative 0.71 compared to their sedentary peers.
So while you might not get back to the levels of a 20-year-old, you have a massive advantage over people your own age who aren't active.
A huge advantage. Your training is actively fighting inflammation. And we see this battle reflected right down at the cellular level in the mitochondria.
The cellular powerhouses.
Exactly. They produce energy, and crucially, they restore it after exercise. The data shows older adults have about a 16% lower phosphocreatine recovery rate constant.
Okay, let's define that term. What does a lower phosphocreatine recovery rate constant mean after, say, a heavy set of squats?
Think of phosphocreatine as the immediate, super-fast fuel for intense muscle contractions, like in a squat. The recovery rate constant is just how fast your muscle can recharge that battery.
So our batteries recharge 16% slower.
Essentially, yes. Recovery is slowing down at the most fundamental level, which is why you might need longer rest periods between sets. But again, the good news is that regular training preserves this capacity. Mm. Trained peers have about 1.2 to 1.3-fold higher capacity than untrained.
Training is the great mitigator.
It's the single greatest mitigator of age-related cellular decline.
Now, here's where it gets really complicated for the listener. The perception versus physiology gap. The sources say masters athletes often feel worse than their objective data might suggest. What's the implication there?
This is truly the masters athlete challenge. Studies show they perceive significantly slower recovery, reporting higher fatigue and soreness, while their objective markers, like lactate clearance or strength, are sometimes similar to younger athletes.
Which creates a huge decision conflict.
A major one. Do you trust the data from your wearable that says you're ready to go? Or do you trust that lingering ache in your hamstring that's screaming, rest day?
And that's exactly why the personalization frameworks and objective monitoring we're going to cover later become so absolutely vital. You need the data to navigate that feeling.
You do.
Okay, let's move on to the foundation.
All right, part two. Before we talk about any fancy tech, any expensive gadget, or any ice bath protocol, we have to respect the evidence hierarchy.
Okay.
And the research is overwhelmingly clear. Sleep and nutrition are the only tier one interventions. They have strong, unassailable evidence.
They're the prerequisites.
They are. If you haven't optimized these two things, you are literally pouring money down the drain on high-tech recovery tools that will give you minimal return.
Let's start with sleep. What does the evidence say about making sleep the number one priority for injury reduction and performance? What's the actual quantitative advantage?
The injury risk reduction is truly unmatched. A big study followed athletes who consistently met both sleep guidelines, so 8.3 or more hours a night, and proper nutrition guidelines.
And what did they find?
A remarkable 75% reduced injury risk.
75%.
75. No other single recovery strategy, or even a stack of them, comes anywhere close to that protective effect. That stat alone should shift sleep from a nice-to-have to a mandatory, managed part of your plan.
And on the performance side?
Well, look at the famous Stanford sleep extension study on their basketball players, when they extended their nightly sleep to 10 hours.
10 hours. Wow.
They saw significant gains in sprint performance, and their shooting accuracy increased by at least 9%. This proves sleep isn't just about avoiding being tired. It's about precision, reaction time, and explosive power.
So if the goal is 8 to 9 hours consistently, what are the specific environmental controls we need to get there?
The research is very specific on this. To achieve that ideal sleep state, you need a pitch black room.
And how dark is pitch black?
It means the light intensity has to be under 3 lux. Basically, if you can see your hand clearly in front of your face, it's too bright.
Okay.
And second, temperature is critical. A cool environment, ideally between 16 to 18 degrees Celsius, that's 60 to 65 Fahrenheit, that cool core body temperature helps you get into that deep, slow wave sleep.
Which is where that growth hormone release happens.
Exactly. And the tough part, the master's reality, is that 64 to 65% of athletes experience sleep disturbances. And being an elite athlete doesn't protect you from this age-related disruption.
So you have to be even more proactive about managing light and temperature.
You have to. But if you can't always get a full 8 hours, say you had a disrupted night, what can you do?
Right. How can you mitigate the damage during the day?
Strategic napping is a valuable tool. A brief nap, around 20 minutes, taken post-training, has been shown to reduce key inflammation markers by about 22% in mature athletes.
So it's not a replacement for a full night, but it's a good tool to have.
It's an effective, acute anti-inflammatory aid that helps pull you out of that catabolic state after a workout.
Okay, let's move to the second part of that tier one foundation, protein. We know masters athletes need more. What's the evidence-based protocol?
It starts with a total daily dose. The consensus now for masters athletes is 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight daily.
And that's a big jump from what younger athletes are told.
It's a 35% increase over the common recommendations, which are usually around 1.2 grams per kilo. So 1.6 is your new baseline. That's the floor.
And what about that critical post-exercise window? How much protein do we need right after a workout?
You need a significantly higher dose than the old 20-gram standard. The ideal post-exercise dose for you now is 35 to 40 grams of high-quality, leucine-rich protein.
Within 30 minutes.
Within 30 minutes post-training. Yes, to maximize that muscle rebuilding response. A 2024 study actually found that a 30-gram dose accelerated muscle rebuilding by 22%. So the 35 to 40 grams is essential if muscle mass is your goal.
Now that high dose used to be a real hurdle for plant-based athletes. Has the science on that changed?
It absolutely has. This is the big plant-based update from the last couple of years. New studies confirm that certain plant protein blends like pea, rice, and canola can match whey for muscle protein synthesis.
But there's a catch, right?
There is. They have to be formulated to be leucine-rich. Leucine is the key amino acid that acts as the anabolic switch. If the plant blend hits that leucine threshold, it works just as well.
Okay, finally, let's touch on micronutrients. Which ones have the highest ROI for immune health and recovery support?
Two stand out with very clear evidence. First, vitamin D. Over half of all athletes are insufficient, especially in the winter.
And supplementation helps.
It does. Even a modest dose, like 1,000 international units or IU daily, showed a powerful protective effect against respiratory infections. It reduced the odds ratio of infection to 0.30 in those who were deficient.
Wow, that's significant.
Very. And second is omega-3 fatty acids. A daily dose of 1 to 3 grams is crucial.
Why omega-3s?
They do two things. One, they reduce systemic inflammation. But two, and this is critical, they actually sensitize your skeletal muscle to those anabolic stimuli we talked about.
So they help that sticky lock on the muscle cell become more receptive to protein.
Exactly. The omega-3s work in the background to make your tier one protein protocol even more effective.
Okay, so this is where we move from the non-negotiable fundamentals into a real strategic trade-off. Cold water immersion, CWI, the ice bath.
Right.
For decades, it's been the gold standard for recovery. But the new evidence suggests it's not a universal good. It actually forces a choice between recovering now and adapting long term.
This is Maybe the most counterintuitive and critical finding for anyone over 40 trying to maintain muscle and strength. The gym wisdom was always that CWI reduces soreness, which helps you train again sooner.
And that's true, isn't it?
It is true for acute short-term relief. But the research shows that in strength-focused training phases, that short-term benefit comes at the direct expense of your long-term muscle-building goals.
Let's get into the research that proved this adaptation blunting problem. What was the landmark study?
That would be the Roberts et al. Study from 2015. It was a game changer. They took resistance-trained men through 12 weeks of strength training. Half used active recovery, the other half did 10 minutes of CWI at 10 degrees Celsius after every workout.
And the results?
They were shocking. Over 12 weeks, the active recovery group gained about 15% in quadriceps mass. The CWI group gained only about 2%.
2% versus 15. That is a massive difference. You're basically giving up almost all of your potential muscle gain by taking an ice bath.
You are.
So what's the mechanism? Why does the cold actively stop the muscle from growing?
It interferes directly with the body's signaling pathways for growth. First, it suppresses what are called satellite cells for 24 to 48 hours. These are your muscle stem cells, the repair crew.
So the repair crew gets sent home.
Pretty much. And second, and maybe more importantly, CWI blunts myonuclear accretion by 26%.
Okay, we need to define myonuclear accretion.
Think of a muscle fiber like a factory.
Mm-hmm.
To make the factory bigger, you need to add more workers or nuclei to manage the increased volume. Myonuclear accretion is the process of adding those new nuclei.
So CWI stops you from hiring more workers for your muscle factory?
By 26%, yes. It directly interrupts the machinery required for muscle hypertrophy. It also suppresses the MTORC1 signaling pathway, which is the main grow signal for your muscles.
And the scientific consensus has confirmed this finding since 2015.
It has. A 2024 meta-analysis confirmed it. Resistance training alone gives you a small to moderate effect on hypertrophy, an SMD of 0.36. Add CWI, and that effect drops to a negligible 0.14. The conclusion is unambiguous.
So, this sounds like we should just avoid CWI completely, but the research also says the effects are mode-dependent.
This is the strategic distinction, and this is what allows us to still use CWI as a tool. The Malta 2021 meta-analysis gave us clear guidance here.
What did it find?
For resistance training adaptations, regular CWI produces a clear harmful effect. The SMD was MIGAs of 0.60, but for endurance training like time trial performance, CWI showed essentially zero effect, an SMD of negative 0.07.
Zero effect. So it doesn't help endurance adaptation, but it doesn't seem to hurt it either.
Exactly. The molecular pathways for endurance are different. They're less susceptible to the negative effects of cold. And this gives us the basis for a strategic timing protocol.
Okay, so let's lay out that protocol for the listener. A phase-based approach.
Right. During strength and hypertrophy phases, the rule is absolute. Avoid CWI entirely after lifting. Use active recovery or heat instead. You cannot afford to suppress that anabolic signal.
But what about competition?
During competition and tournament phases, this is where CWI is strongly recommended. When adaptation doesn't matter and all you care about is performing tomorrow.
Like a three-day tournament.
Exactly. CWI provides real benefits for reducing soreness and improving next-day sprint speed. The protocol is specific. 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, that's 50 to 59 Fahrenheit, for 11 to 15 minutes within an hour of competition.
What about the idea of just delaying the ice bath by a few hours?
That's the delay nuance. The theory is that if you wait 4 to 6 hours, you let that initial growth signal happen before you suppress it with cold. But, and this is a big but, that specific timing is theoretically sound, but not directly tested in robust human trials. We can't scientifically recommend it for strength gains.
So if someone wants the soreness reduction without the adaptation risk after lifting, is there another option?
Yes. Contrast water therapy, or CWT, is the preferred alternative. It seems to give you comparable soreness relief with potentially fewer adaptation concerns.
And what's the protocol for CWT?
It's usually a 4-to-1 ratio. So 4 minutes hot, around 38 to 40 Celsius, followed by 1 minute cold, around 8 to 15 Celsius. And you repeat that for 3 or 4 cycles. The rapid shift in temperature creates a pumping effect that helps clear waste.
Okay, let's move on. Part 4, the priority paradox and equipment ROI.
Now we shift from the body's internal response to the external market. We have to frame this around return on investment for the athlete who has limited time and budget.
The priority paradox, where consistency and adherence always trump cost.
Always. Time is your most valuable commodity. So let's walk through the equipment investment hierarchy, starting with the absolute highest ROI.
The quickest wins for the lowest friction.
And that is the highest ROI starter kit. It's all about soft tissue tools.
Yeah.
Foam rollers, massage sticks, massage balls. These dominate the market for a reason. They are low cost, low friction, and always accessible at home.
We have some prices on these.
We do. The entry point is usually between $21 and $75. You can get a great massage ball for $20 or a collapsible roller like the Brazen Moor for around $40.
And the time commitment is minimal.
5 to 15 minutes. It fits into any schedule. The high practical ROI means people actually use them. This is where you start, not where you finish.
So what's the next step up?
The high ROI upgrade, which is situational, is a massage gun. Percussive therapy.
Like a Theragun or a Hypervolt.
Right. Prices range from around $200 for a mini to $330 for a pro model. But their ROI is only high if localized soreness or trigger points are consistently limiting your training.
So they solve a very specific problem.
A very specific problem of deep, localized knots. You should only buy one after you've proven you'll actually use the $40 roller and ball consistently.
Okay, moving up the price ladder to compression boots.
This is squarely in the moderate ROI category.
Hmm.
Devices like the Normatec or Jet Boots are around $800. Their clinical benefits are well established for reducing soreness, but their ROI hinges on one single factor.
And what's that?
Time. They force you to be completely still for at least 15 minutes, often 30 to 45. If you are a busy 40-year-old who cannot consistently carve out that uninterrupted time, the ROI collapses, no matter how good the device is. They have to replace dead time, like watching TV. If they become another chore, they become an expensive paperweight.
And finally, at the bottom of the ROI list.
Lowest ROI is cryotherapy equipment. The cost and facility requirements are just astronomical. This remains concentrated in elite settings and is not an efficient or consistent use of resources for the general athlete.
This brings us to a major psychological trap, the synergy myth. The idea that if one thing is good, stacking two or three things must be exponentially better.
It's a very appealing idea that 1 + 1 = 5. But the research confirms that combinations rarely produce these dramatic synergistic effects. At best, they're additive. 1 + 1 = 2.
You're just duplicating recovery pathways.
Pretty much. And we have concrete evidence. Combining CWI with 24-hour compression showed only a minor trend towards reduced inflammation, with no significant differences in strength or soreness compared to doing either one alone.
And we see the same thing with soft tissue work and stretching.
Absolutely. The meta-analysis on foam rolling plus stretching found no additional range of motion benefit compared to just doing one of them. The most reliable synergy remains between the tier one interventions, sleep, and high-dose protein.
Okay, so that leads us to part five, monitoring and adjustment, trusting the data.
We established that master's athlete challenge, that gap between feeling and reality. This means you absolutely need objective metrics. And the main tool here is heart rate variability, or HRV.
Right. Explain HRV for us again.
Heart rate variability is just the variation in time between your successive heartbeats. It's a great indicator of your autonomic nervous system status, which reflects your recovery readiness.
So high HRV is good?
Typically, yes.
It
indicates a healthy balance and resilience. But the key is how you interpret it. And the biggest mistake people make is panicking over one low score.
The daily grade on a report card.
Exactly. And that's the wrong way to look at it. The fundamental rule is the trend rule. Do not overreact to single night changes.
Look at the bigger picture.
You have to. Decisions must be driven by rolling 3-day and 7-day averages. A single low night is just noise. A sustained downward trend over 7 days, that's a signal. That's when you adjust your training load.
And how accurate are these consumer wearables?
The gold standard is an ECG chest strap. A wearable is considered good enough for trends if it's within about 5% for resting heart rate and within about 10 milliseconds for HRV compared to that reference.
And it's all relative, right? My number versus someone else's doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter at all. You have to focus on relative changes over time against your own personal baseline. If your HRV is 20% below your 14-day average for 3 days in a row, that's the signal you need to listen to.
In terms of device comparisons for 2024 or 2025, is there a clear leader in consistency?
The balance of evidence favors the Oura Ring, the Gen 3 or 4. It provides a very clean signal from the finger during sleep and shows the most consistency with the ECG reference.
And what about WWatt?
Whoop 4.0 is acceptable for trend lines, but the data can be noisier. Studies show it can have outliers up to 25 milliseconds versus the reference, especially at higher HRV values. So you trust the trend, but you filter the day-to-day noise a bit more heavily.
I see Garmin is also making a push to integrate all this data.
They are. Garmin's 2024 Recovery Hub is a big step forward. It pools wearable data like sleep and HRV with third-party recovery devices into one unified dashboard. The goal is to connect the data directly to a recommended action.
So because a significant number of athletes, maybe 30%, are high or low responders to these things due to genetics, generic protocols are going to fail a lot of people. This brings us to the N-of-1 personalization framework.
The N-of-1 trial is the most rigorous way to figure out what works for you. It means you run a multi-cycle crossover test on yourself.
You become your own science experiment.
You do. You establish a baseline for a few weeks, then you test a single intervention like omega-3s or a CWT protocol for 4 to 8 weeks. You track the outcome, take a washout period, and then try the control.
And what are the most reliable markers to track during a self-experiment like that?
You need metrics that are highly reliable, that don't fluctuate wildly. The counter movement jump, or CMJ, is excellent. It has a coefficient of variation of only 4%, making it great for testing neuromuscular fatigue.
And what about something like creatine kinase?
Creatine kinase, or CK, which signals muscle damage, shows about 42% baseline variability. It's just too noisy and unreliable for tracking specific recovery outcomes on an individual level. You can't separate the signal from the noise.
So finally, what are the concrete red flags? When does a 40-year-old athlete need to back off, no matter what their training plan says?
The metrics signal a necessary load reduction when two things happen at the same time. One, HRV shows a sustained downward trend, and or your resting heart rate shows a sustained upward drift across 3 to 7 days.
Okay, that's the objective signal.
And two, your perceived fatigue and soreness get worse at the same time, and your session quality starts to drop. If your body's objective data and your subjective data are both screaming stop, you have to listen.
Okay, let's wrap this all together in part 6, progressive implementation and avoiding common mistakes.
We've covered the foundation, the trade-offs, and the monitoring. Now let's talk about the priority order for implementation. We need a logical sequence based on cost, friction, and impact.
And this has to start not with buying something, but with building in structural capacity.
Correct. Step one is the highest ROI, zero-cost intervention, structural capacity. That means building adequate rest into your schedule. For master's athletes, that's a minimum of 2 dedicated rest days per week.
And a deload week.
And a rigorous deload rhythm of 1 recovery week for every 2 harder weeks. A 1-to-2 cycle. This is the single biggest difference between surviving and thriving.
Okay, step two.
Step two, soft tissue tools. Spend that $20 to $75 on a foam roller and a ball. Low friction, high adherence.
Step three.
Passive monitoring. Start wearing your HRV tracker nightly. It's passive and gives you the data you need for later.
Step four.
Massage gun if needed. The situational upgrade for those persistent localized issues. Compression boots, if time permits. Only if you can guarantee that 15 plus minutes of stillness. Don't let them create more stress.
And finally, step six.
Facility modalities. Use things like cryo or professional massage as occasional budget-dependent tools, not daily necessities.
This structural focus also applies to how we design our training plan, the periodization.
Absolutely. Masters athletes really benefit from undulating periodization. That just means you vary volume and intensity non-linearly.
So not just a straight line of increasing difficulty.
Right. Research found this method produced 28% faster strength gains in trained lifters. It manages recovery demands better because the stimulus is always changing, which is kinder on the older athlete system.
And what if you're doing concurrent training, mixing strength and cardio?
You have to respect 2 rules to minimize the interference effect. First, separate the sessions by at least 3 hours. And second, if they have to be in the same session, do your strength training before your aerobic work.
Okay. And what about mobility and stretching? Do the rules change for aging tissue?
They do. You want to use dynamic stretching for 10 to 15 minutes before exercise. This reduces injury risk by 33%. Then, after exercise, you use static stretching for 20 to 60 second holds.
And longer holds are better for older tissue.
They are. Studies show 60 second holds produced greater hamstring flexibility gains in older adults. Aging tissue just needs a more prolonged stimulus to adapt.
Right.
And finally, incorporate balance and proprioceptive training. This is huge for injury prevention. It's been shown to reduce ACL injury rates by 50 to 51%.
Okay, let's end by clearly defining the most common mistakes that sabotage the master's athlete.
They usually fall into 4 specific traps. First is a mindset error.
The denial mistake.
Believing your body is still 20 and trying to maintain that same training density. This leads directly to fatigue and injury. The fix is just strict adherence to those rest days and deload weeks.
What's next?
The tech mistake. This is the ROI collapse. Buying the $800 boots before mastering the foam roller. High adherence to low-cost basics always wins.
I can see that, the monitoring mistake.
Treating HRV as a daily grade instead of a 3 to 7 day trend line, you have to ignore the noise and wait for the signal. Overreacting just causes stress.
And finally,
the nutrient mistake. Skipping post-workout protein and carbs, or only taking that old lower 20-gram dose, you have to hit that 35 to 40-gram dose post-training to maximize the anabolic window you have.
Avoid those mistakes, follow the framework, and you're set up for sustained performance.
Absolutely.
This has been an incredibly analytical deep dive into reverse engineering recovery for the 40-year-old athlete. Let's summarize the three most crucial, actionable takeaways.
Okay. Number one. The priority paradox.
Ah.
Structural recovery is tier one and the highest ROI. That means sleep 8 to 9 hours in a pitch black cool room and protein intake 1.6 grams per kilo daily with 35 to 40 grams post-training. Master that before buying anything expensive.
Got it. Number two.
The CWI trade-off. Never use cold water immersion after strength training. It can blunt your muscle adaptation by up to 30%. Reserve it exclusively for competition recovery when next day readiness is the only goal.
And number three.
The personalization pathway. Ignore single-night HRV dips. Use 3 to 7 day rolling averages to track your trends. And implement that N-of-1 self-testing framework with a reliable marker like the counter movement jump to find out what actually works for your unique biology.
Ultimately, the goal isn't to eliminate these age-related changes, but to manage them strategically, armed with data. The research really confirms that your training status and your recovery optimization matter far more than your chronological age.
Right. The 40-year-old who recovers strategically will outperform the 25-year-old who ignores these truths every single time. The science is there to extend high performance for decades, but only if you respect the biological reality of where you are now.
Find full research, citations, and source material for this deep dive at research.yuda.me. That's yuda.me. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.